طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. This week, our Palestinian voice is that of old friend, Professor Mazen Kumsia, who never fails to challenge us with the depth of his political analysis. Today, we feature Mazen speaking to the Jerusalem Fund in Washington, D.C. on May 22nd, 2018. Mazen Kumsia is a geneticist who taught at Duke and Yale universities before returning to his home in Beit Sahor, Palestine, where he continues to teach at Bethlehem University and Beerzeit University. He is also the founder and director of the Museum of Natural History at Bethlehem University. Here is Mazen Kumsia speaking on Mayhem versus Sanity in Western Asia, Why Palestine is Still the Issue, in a return engagement before the Jerusalem Fund in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much for coming. I know it's the last day of Ramadan, and for those celebrating the holiday, Eid Fitr Sa'id. I don't want to, of course, I talked last year about different subject. I want to talk today about something that been on my mind a lot lately, with the carnage, especially that's going on in Gaza, that made it fresh in my mind, if you want. Palestinians have paid a very heavy price, of course, since the foundation of the State of Israel, since 1948. Over 100,000 Palestinians have been killed, over 800,000 were injured, and over 700,000 were detained or imprisoned. Just in the past few weeks, as you know, there was over 140 Palestinians who were killed, and over 10,000 who were injured, many with live ammunition. Those who were killed in the past few weeks included paramedics like Razan Najjar, or quadriplegic like this guy who lost his legs actually in the previous attack in 2014. It included an 8-month-old baby who was suffocated from tear gas. It included press people, included children, etc. These were part of what's called the Great Marches of Return, which are basically attempts by the besieged people of Gaza to demonstrate that they have not forgotten their homes and lands from which they were expelled in 1948. As you know, Gaza is 2 million people imprisoned, open-air prison, and those 2 million people, most of them are refugees, 70% of them are refugees from 1948. And I thought it was kind of interesting what this artist did with his demolished home in Gaza. But also, Israel is using these exploding bullets, if you want, which medically is devastating. They shatter bones, they destroy. So many people lost their limbs in Gaza. Actually, I'm attending a National Geographic conference, and I was talking just today to a guy who made the presentation about 3D printers that print the casts for those limbs. So he said, this, we can supply the 3D printer anywhere, and we can just take pictures and then create it. So I said, this may be an opportunity for us to cooperate and have him do this in Gaza because it could help a lot of people who are missing limbs and who don't have artificial limbs like they were here. The other thing that happened since I spoke here a year ago, of course, is this spectacle of Mr. Trump and his cronies basically, quote-unquote, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And I don't want to talk too much about it, but it's, I mean, it was rightly described as an American-Israeli colony in Jerusalem rather than an embassy in Jerusalem. But ironically, in the picture illustrates what somebody did with Photoshop, because in parallel, the same day they opened this embassy, so to speak, embassy, by Mr. Kushner and Friedman and others who support the colonial system in the West Bank, there was this bloody carnage in Gaza in which 60 people in that day lost their lives. Many things have happened also since I came here a year ago. As you may have heard also, Ahed Tamimi, a friend of mine who I knew her and her family for past 10 years or 12 years, she was actually resisting when she was 9 years old, and now she's in Israeli jail with her brother and with her mother. And the charge for her mother was that basically she videotaped and put things on Facebook, which I considered incitement. And for Ahed, the charge was that she slapped a soldier who was in her yard, basically, and just they were shooting at Palestinian children in Nabi Saleh. And actually, one of her relatives, her cousin, got a bullet in his head, and he lost, like, part of his skull. They had to remove and reconfigure surgery, etc. And she was so affected by this, the fact that her cousin was hit, that she didn't want a soldier shooting from their yard at other children, and so that's why she slapped him. But anyway, she's spending time in Israeli jails for this. Lots of things happen in a year, so to speak. And for me, actually, all the things happen are one pile, and this last 2 days have been another pile in terms of emotional pressure on me. And I'll tell you why. Because the last 2 days there were demonstrations in support of Gaza in the West Bank, and these demonstrations were brutally disbanded by the Palestinian Authority. This to me is much worse emotionally than what the Israelis were doing in Gaza, or which is what you expect colonialists to do. You know, they butcher Palestinians. But for us to have the Palestinian Authority act as a Vichy government, and I'm sorry to use harsh terms, but for example, this is, they dressed as civilians. This is all yesterday, by the way. They dressed as civilians, and they went in beating and dragging people. Many of them are friends of mine. Sorry. But, you know, and people photographed them, and now we identified them. We know who they are, that they are indeed Palestinian security services who were doing this. These are the people who are trained by the Dayton, you know, the American training of the Palestinian preventive security, as they call it. So, and even high-level Palestinian officials, as this gentleman who you see there meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, were participating in beating and arresting people to try and show off that they are really loyal to Mahmoud Abbas. Of course, you know, what alleviates some of the pain is that there's a lot of international solidarity with Gaza. There's a lot of international caring about Gaza, and it's growing. And as you know, there are ships that are going to Gaza. Next month I'll be on those ships going to Gaza. And these ships, four ships that have already toured many ports of coal in Europe, the last ports will be in Italy. And people are very sympathetic to the Palestinian cause around the world. And we'll come back to all of this. I'm just explaining very briefly in the beginning kind of things that happened in a year, upon which I want to then build some sort of analysis, which is very tentative, and I hope that you will help me in the question and answer, that we can focus this to see where we are going. In the medical field, we say it's very, you know, you take a patient history, you make a diagnosis, but then the more critical is to apply therapy, of course. You know, what's a therapy? So that's the part that we will talk about together, because I'm not sure I know all the answers. I don't know, you know, tiny fraction of what might be the answers. There are other things happening in the Middle East which you probably also heard about. For example, there were demonstrations in Jordan, both when they moved the embassy, large demonstrations, and also more recently in the past few weeks, demonstrations about the issues that revolve around the economy in Jordan. Jordan has billions of dollars in debt, and they added 15 billion more in debt by working with Israel to build this canal between the Red Sea and the Dead Sea. I don't know if you heard about that. And this canal is being built on the Jordanian side of the border in Wadi Araba. And the reason it's on the Jordanian side of the border, even though Israel gets most of the benefits, is that it actually leaves Jordan holding the bag of the IMF and World Bank debts of $15 billion for this canal. So the Jordanian public will end up holding this debt. So obviously the World Bank has, you know, like they do in most other countries that they loan money to. There is a book called The Economic Hitman, I don't know if you heard about it, which speaks about how they do these things, so that they subjugate third world countries. And so, yeah, you know, you build infrastructure that the country doesn't need, you loan them a lot of money which you know they cannot pay back, and then you start to force them to do downsizing. Their public rises up, says, we can't do this. So then you say, okay, we'll give you more money, but then you have to do what we tell you to do. And I think this is part of the plan that Trump and his administration have for Jordan, because they do need Jordan for this deal of the century that they are doing. You heard about the deal of the century, which is to liquidate the Palestinian struggle, leave Israel in hegemony over the Middle East, and the issues of refugees. Refugees don't return to their homes and lands. And this is the plan. These are parts of the demonstrations in Jordan. The other thing that happened last week, for example, was in Afula, hundreds of Israelis demonstrated. What they demonstrated for is the fact that there's one house that was sold to an Arab guy, Arab Israeli, and so they didn't want any Arabs in their neighborhood. This is increasingly happening inside the so-called Israeli state. The other thing that happened in the past year is that the Palestinian Authority also instituted gag orders on things, so that they called, because we don't have a legislator anymore and Abu Mazen was not re-elected, so he's de facto become a dictator. So he issued a law that says any posts on Facebook that they deem offensive would mean that this is a crime. So, and they actually arrested a friend of ours, Isa Amru, for a while. And you can see me here demonstrating with the others about this electronic crime law that Abu Mazen, so-called law that Abu Mazen signed. And of course, you heard that Mr. Trump met with Mr. Kim. Now, why is this also a relevant event? It's because basically, you know, the message that it sends is an amazing message that I couldn't believe that the United States want to send to the world, which is that, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and if you have nuclear weapons and if you are a threat to the world, we will respect you, we'll work with you. But if you give up your weapons, or if you don't have them anyway, we can knock you down, kill you, like we did with Saddam Hussein and Libya's Gaddafi. This is the message that's sent out now to every tin pot dictator around the world. Get your hands on some nuclear weapons, they will really respect you then. There was the wedding of Prince Harry, I guess. You know, one could spin around that if you want. But there is something that we have to really acknowledge, and I'm becoming more and more aware of it even from outside the United States, and I was aware of it from inside the United States. I lived here for 29 years. And that is the level of disconnect from reality that our leaders have. That our leaders, whoever they are, really think of themselves as somehow, you know, kings of the world. You know, they can move the world, even when they don't have power, like Prince William. You know, they think that they can change the world and that they have a right to change the world to whatever they like. Okay. And this came to mind, we must always think about things, and we must think about things as they are, not as they are said to be by the powers to be, as George Bernard Shaw said. The greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance, it is the illusion of knowledge. And we have a lot of illusion of knowledge around us. But now I want to, okay, now I kind of said to you what I been witnessing in the past year since I came and spoke at this podium last year, in March I think it was. Now I want to think about geopolitics a little bit. And it sounds like a big world, and sounds like complicated, it sounds like people like me who's a biologist shouldn't even delve in geopolitics because, hell, it's complicated, there's all these players, there's the regional players, international players, etc. But it's really not very difficult to understand the world. The world is rather simple, actually, even though they try to spin it as complicated, but it's really simple. Herzl, for example, is somebody who's, you know, intelligent guy, brilliant guy. I actually wish we have Arab leaders as brilliant as Herzl in terms of organizing and being able to bring people of various backgrounds, you know, leftists, rightists, religious people, non-religious people, atheists, bring them all together under one umbrella and saying, here, let's work for a cause. It doesn't matter what this cause is, but in his case, of course, his case was colonialism, Zionism as colonialism. And he said, you know, a Zionist colony in the Middle East would be serve as a rampart for Western, for Europe against Asia, an outpost of civilization against barbarism. Now, by contrast that, I think what the outcome happened is very clear, and a lot of what we saw in the pictures earlier are symptoms, if you want, of this colonialism, right? And they are understandable symptoms. I'm not saying excusable symptoms, but they are understandable in the context of colonialism in the same way that you understand what happened to Native Americans here and the butchery of not only the people, but even their livelihood, like 2 million buffaloes that were killed in the prairies, etc. I think colonialism was actually not such a global phenomena as it is today. This may, again, in the discussion, I hope you will correct me, and I hope we can together come up with a different... I think we have colonialism today to a larger extent than we had it 200 years ago, but I think it's a different kind of colonialism. That's all. It's just metamorphosed into a new type, which is economic colonialism, colonialism by proxies instead of having British boots on the ground, or American boots on the ground, you have proxy governments like bin Laden or whatever his name is, bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, that's doing the bids of imperialism and colonialism. That's one point I want to make, and I'm not sure you agree with me or not on this, but I think it's an interesting point of departure or discussion. The other thing I want to say is that when in the past King Leopold killed however many millions of people in the Congo, it was a local phenomenon that, you know, nobody really cared about. Nobody even heard about it. Most Europeans are oblivious at the time to what was happening there. Today, you know, colonialism effect is globalized in the sense that we do have a global community. We do have networking. We do have people traveling by airplanes, you know, from one place to another very quickly, except if they are Palestinians like me. It takes me 2.5 days to get here, and then they question me at every airport, etc., and that's another story. But if it's normal, you fly from Tel Aviv to New York, and that's the end of the story, or to Washington, D.C. So what Arnold Toynbee kind of said in 1961, he said this, by the way, he said is the tragedy in Palestine is not just a local one. It is a tragedy for the world because it is an injustice that is a menace to world peace. And I think he was very prophetic in this, that actually it's no longer local conflict. It's not an issue just for Palestine, or for Yemen, for that matter, or for Syria. It is now a global issue. Every issue is a global issue. And this probably started in the 20th century with the globalization of the world and easy communications, telephones, fax machines, and most recently emails and internet and Instagram and Facebook and whatever. Things have become interconnected, and South Africa, we saw, for example, how that was a global struggle, not just a struggle for the people of South Africa, it was a struggle for all of us. I was actually involved in this marginally, actually, when I was at the University of Connecticut in 1980. I invited the speaker, who later I found out was a member of ANC, of course, ANC was a terrorist organization at the time, as it was described by Ronald Reagan and just about every Western power there is. This is a globalized struggle also because it started globally. You know, the British and the French were the key to establishing the State of Israel, right? In the form of the Balfour and the Cambon declarations, which were parallel declarations in support of the Zionist project. And Balfour actually wrote to his successor in the Foreign Office in 1919, Lord Curzon, saying that basically we don't care whether Zionism right or wrong. We're not interested in that. We just know that this is good for us, for the empire, basically. And so we support it. It's of the words he used, it's of far profounder import to us than the wishes and the whims and biases or whatever of the local people. That's the words he used. Churchill was a typical imperialist. He was a racist to the core, by the way. One of the worst war criminals in history, not a war hero, as I like to give him credit for. And this is, for example, a quote from from Churchill in October 1941, which is also prophetic in many ways, is that, you know, after the war, what we will do is create a Jewish state, which will bring in millions of Jews to live in that state, and this will be good also for the empire. There are many examples of this. I want to just go through a few examples of how this is all connected globally in the 20th century, especially with respect to Palestine. You know, after career diplomats in 1930 issued a government-backed white paper suggesting tying Jewish immigration to Palestine, to Palestinian economic conditions or interests at the time, and not just to whatever the Yishuv told them to do, the local Zionist organizations, basically. And the reason, by the way, they came up with this white paper is because there was an uprising just before that, 1929, which was uprising number five, Intifada number five. We had, by the way, 14 intifadas or uprisings. The first intifada was not 1987, it was 1881, if you want, which was actually successful. But anyway, that's another story. But when they did issue the white paper in response to the pressure from the local people, Weizmann and other Zionists pressured the British government, told them, hey, what are you doing? You forgot about the Sykes-Picot and the Balfour and Jules Cambon declarations. And so the British had to step back from it. This is, by the way, also something that I have debates sometimes with some people in America about, including Noam Chomsky, about, you know, the tail wagging the dog or the dog wagging the tail, so to speak. I think, you know, we have to acknowledge certain facts about this that can be investigated by anybody, really, about the power of the Zionist lobby in Washington, for example, and how it influences and shapes U.S. foreign policy, and not that Israel, as Chomsky said, is like a U.S. Land-based airplane carrier or something to that effect. No, I'm sorry. Israel has more power in Washington than Donald Trump has. When there was a strong sentiment in the U.S., for example, to help European Jews in 1939, 1940, 1941, the Zionist lobby in Washington actually lobbied to close the door against Jewish immigration because they wanted all Jews to go to just to Palestine. They wanted that. And they succeeded even before AIPAC was founded. You know, Truman, why did Truman support the partition of Palestine, the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine? He said it very clearly in front of his cabinet. All of them were against it, by the way, including all the intelligence services in the U.S., the predecessor of the CIA at the time. All of them were against it, but Truman said, well, I have to do it. And he said in a meeting of these cabinet ministers at the time, gentlemen, and they were all men, of course, white men. Gentlemen, you know, I don't have a large Arab constituency who's going to make me a president. He was going to run for president. When the U.S., when Israel just about, you know, now, what are we now, 51 years later, but it is the last week was an anniversary of the attack on the USS Liberty and killing of Navy men on that ship in international water, intentionally, by the way, and everybody on that ship swore that this was intentional. And, of course, it was swept under the carpet. So why is it swept under the carpet if it is really the dog wagging the tail, so to speak? You know, we have a slew, and I don't have to tell you this, you know about these things. We have a slew of international figures, important people like Dennis Ross and Martin Indyk and others who basically worked as lobbyists for the State of Israel and then became significant officials in the administration. Martin Indyk was actually an Australian guy. He came here and they speeded up his immigration paper so that they can appoint him as ambassador to Israel. There's things like Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, and Douglas Faith, and others, and neoconservatives, and how they pushed for the war in Iraq. You can read the book by Mearsheimer and Walt, for example, about why we ended up in Iraq. It wasn't because of oil or because of weapons of mass destruction or terrorism or anything like that. It was because of Israel. This is the reality that we have to acknowledge. A war that cost us, American taxpayers, $3 trillion. There's actually a Harvard economist who wrote a book about this called, title of the book is The $3 Trillion War. And the U.S. has $21 trillion in debt, of which $9 trillion, to be precise, $9 trillion are due to our wars on the Middle East, on the people of the Middle East, that are done on the behest of Israel, whether it's in Syria and Iraq, in Afghanistan, or in Yemen now. This letter I kind of dug up because I think it's relevant to our questions here. You know, our, and I say our founding fathers because I'm an American citizen also, our founding fathers like Jefferson were actually very insightful about some things that could happen and would happen. And I think this letter that's sent by Jefferson to a rabbi who invited him to basically cut the ribbon on opening the synagogue, it said it all. It says basically, you know, nice that you told me about all the suffering of Jews around the world, etc. But, you know, it confirms in my mind what actually happens is that any sect, if you put it in charge, you know, it will cause suffering for other people. So we were trying here, and he's admitting that they are not succeeding at it. It takes some time. We're trying to remedy this via laws. And I think that's very, very prophetic, again, of Thomas Jefferson. The other thing we have to think about is that politics and economy are interconnected. And this demonstrations in Jordan, as I showed you earlier, illustrate this, that you cannot isolate economy from politics. This is the supposed average GDP per capita in different Arab states, oil-rich states like in the Gulf region. You can see the average per capita is what is given. For example, Qatar is the highest, and then you have you know, United Arab Emirates followed by the others. Like Kuwait, etc. But this is not the real picture. The real picture is, of course, the disparity between this. When we say the average is, for example, 68,000, doesn't mean that, you know, many people make 68,000. Actually, they either make millions and billions or they make zero. Saudi Arabia actually is one of the poorest number of poor people in Saudi Arabia. It is huge. People are literally walking around in the desert like they did 1,500 years ago. They are desperately poor. And of course, you have people like, again, what's his name, the guy that's in charge, you know, has billions and billions of dollars. And these guys, you know, they take the money of these countries and they give them as they wish. For example, this guy, he sat down with Trump. Well, Trump very insultingly, you know, sitting with him and saying, look what this guy gave us for nothing. You know, here's billions here, billions there, billions there. He had even a chart in front of him. I mean, it's almost like a doctored picture, but it's an actual picture. It's unbelievable. And they have the chutzpah, if I may use that word, to say that they are Arabs, you know, when they are actually killing people in Yemen, for example, starving people and children in Yemen. This to me is amazing, you know, that we allow such spectacle to go on in our part of the world. Now I want to switch a little bit again. You know, you'd have to excuse me for this presentation because I want to kind of give what you call all the symptoms of the problems of humanity. And then towards the end, I want, with your help, to try and arrive at something rather coherent or logical. We face unprecedented dangers today. And when I mentioned that before, colonialism or even genocide, as happened in Congo, were localized phenomena, today there's no localized phenomena. Because, for example, pushing the issue of Iran or South North Korea and all of this stuff could end up in nuclear war, by the way, which is, you know, the people, the scientists who are putting that clock, if you remember, they're saying, like, we are 2 minutes to midnight. We as a species could begun, or at least as organized human societies, we may go back to being, foragers and hunters, foragers, whatever. And we may be having forced to eat roaches because they will survive and proliferate after nuclear war. So a nuclear war could devastate the human society. But also the environmental issue, which I don't have time to go into, but it's my passion as a biologist to speak about climate change and what's happening and all of this stuff. These two dangers, global climate change and global nuclear war, could end Homo sapiens as an organized, quote-unquote, civilization, although I may debate with you whether we are civilized or not yet. But anyways, I put the slide about biodiversity. So now we need to push that button, call to action, because if we don't do that, if we don't think what is our role and how are we going to affect this transformation to go back to a level of sanity so that we don't have people like Netanyahu and Abu Mazen and Trump heading our affairs, we are in trouble, not just as local communities here in America or in Palestine or in Israel or whatever, but as a species we have problem. And I think we have to really start to appreciate the level of the danger that we face. I put this picture because it illustrates human diversity. And human diversity is strength for us. The fact that we have people who work for human justice around the world, and even at the National Geographic, by the way, headquarters, where I'm attending this Explorer Symposium, I can tell there is a disparity between those in power at the institution and the people who are doing a lot of the work. What do I mean by that? Even when I registered, by the way, for National Geographic Explorer community, I scrolled down to put my country. There's nothing there. Doesn't have Palestine, doesn't have West Bank and Gaza. I looked under O for occupied Palestinian territory. There's nothing. So what am I going to do, you know? And I'm still struggling with them. Hopefully they can change that. But on the other hand, I'm talking to people there, you know, from all corners of the world, Indonesia, Malaysia, Kenya, who are doing amazing work, local work that really makes a difference in the lives of common people. But these are people who don't have the power. So this is the other part of the conundrum which I want us to think about, is the people who are doing the good work are not the people who are in power. And the people who are in power are the ones who are doing more damage than they are doing good. How do we remedy this? How do we, and I was actually met with Ralph Nader, and Claire Nader is here, and we talked yesterday. And he gave me his book about power, and I was reading in it. And it's a remarkable little book because it was, explaining that there are times in human history when indeed there was effective power. And if you think about it, even in American history, what are the positive things that happened to us here as Americans? And how did we get those things? Right of woman to vote, civil rights, ending the war in Vietnam, 40-hour work week, workman safety, highway safety, using even car seat belts, which Ralph Nader was key in doing that. All of these things happened to us because, these little people, if you want, got together and said, there's something not quite right, we have to fix it. Now, we are in 4.5 billion years of Earth history, a beautiful planet, by the way, and we humans are in the past 8,000 years, which is nothing in world history. And humans could, as I said, could go and, dinosaurs also went, so Earth, I'm not worried about Earth. Earth will survive us, with us or without us, Earth will go on. But I do care about human species because I'm part of it and we want to do something different, right? So here comes what I consider part of the solution, which is resistance. And I like this figure, even though I don't know where I got it from. It's not mine. But anyways, it talks about becoming more human in the sense of becoming more connected to our needs and our society and how we connect to this. And we have to also be optimistic because nothing stays the same. Trump will be gone one way or the other. Netanyahu will be gone. All of these things will change. Nothing stays the same. And I take solace from the hopes of people like Arundhati Roy, who said that another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. And, you know, things like that, like Martin Luther King, what he said is, you know, people need to act, basically. And Frederick Douglass, for example, said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. I would like someday, when I meet Abu Mazen, is to give him this quote in Arabic. You know, it doesn't happen by going to them and begging for the morsels of giving us a state, you know. And to end, I like, my wife is Chinese American, so I like Chinese proverbs. To know and not to do is not to know. Better to light a candle than curse the darkness. I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand. And for us Palestinians, doing things on the ground is the best school. So when politicians say, what's to do? I say, go down to the street. Go down and demonstrate with us. Go down, get arrested with us. And yesterday I spoke at Plymouth Church and the Reverend Hagler was actually just arrested in the Poor People's March. So I want to kind of leave you with a question and for us to discuss it together. I want to hear your opinion about how we collectively can move together to a better world. Because ultimately we don't have much of a choice. We either, as I said, we either as a species we fail or as a species we succeed. There's no winners and losers in the conflicts that are happening today. I'm sorry, Saudi Arabia is not going to win the war on Yemen or the Yemeni resistance going to win over Saudi hegemony. Wars are lose-lose. And lose-lose scenarios that are getting more and more devastating because wars 200 years ago, 80, 90, 95% of the victims of the ones who lose their lives were the soldiers fighting it. Today, less than 1% of those who are fighting the war are soldiers, who are victims of wars are the soldiers. The remainder are civilians. That's who pays the price. So we cannot, and even soldiers, by the way, they pay a much heavier price also now because of the way the wars are fought and because of the way they see the wars are being fought. So the biggest killer of American soldiers now, do you know what? Suicide. 22 a day are committing suicide. So, you know, it's amazing. So anyway, I'll stop here and I want to thank you for your attention and I hope you sign the email list that we passed around and I'm happy to talk about any subject you want because I'm not, you know.
Thank you. Dr. Mazen, thank you so much for a great presentation. Thank you. So now we'll take some questions. Again, please just wait for the mic to come to you before you begin. So let's start with that.
Hi, Dan Levitt. Hi, Mazen. You know, I have a website, Alternative Insight. I think you distributed quite a few of the articles. And I want to get back to your redefinition of colonialism, I did write an article, I don't know if you read it, called The New Puritans. And in it, I try to relate Israel as being the New Puritans. And the reason is the Puritans, they came because of supposedly religious persecution, but they really came under the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and they had to establish industry and commerce here in return. And of course, in the early years, they were welcomed by the native population and managed to then extinguish the native population. And that really set the stage, actually, for the total extinguishment of the Native American population. And I think that sort of has a parallel, you know, to the present excursion of the Zionists into, you know, to that area of Palestine. So I want to think what you think of that comparison.
You know, I just wrote, a couple of chapters and books that are coming up on colonial and post-colonial history and trying to analyze things. You know, most of the world was either colonized or colonizer. Maybe Switzerland was the only country that has never been colonized. Maybe it was, I don't remember. But anyways, most countries had the history of colonization and or being colonized, sometimes both, like Spain. But they were, as I said, kind of local phenomena in the past. Nowadays, with the transformation of colonialism to this neoliberal colonialism with the World Bank and the economic hegemony and the impoverishment of places like Gaza and other and most countries in Africa, for example, colonialism has become this global phenomenon. And I think the response to it is similar to the majority of the response that happened to colonialism in the past, which is resistance that leads to what? For most countries, 98% of the countries that were colonized, it leads to one country for all its people. I wrote a book about the subject with regards to Palestine called Sharing the Land of Canaan. So if you look at South America, Central America, Caribbean islands, all of these countries, Canada, etc., there's an integration of the colonial with the colonial colonized people into one country. Not a perfect solution, but it's okay. It's better than the other two scenarios, which I won't go into. One is the Algerian model, and one is the genocide model, like happened in Australia and the United States. But the point of coexistence in the context of post-colonial struggle, we have to think of it now in terms of how do we deal with this. The colonial idea has to be dropped, clearly. Colonial idea was dropped in Brazil or Argentina or Chile or any of these things. So the colonial idea of the economic colonialism and the hegemony that is there has to be dropped. But then we can live together. Then we can talk about living together. But this time, instead of in local nation states or whatever, we're talking about at the global level on this blue planet that we have to live together in somewhat of an equality. That's how I'm looking at it. Clearly, you cannot continue to have this disparity of wealth or disparity of power. And clearly, we cannot have people like, you know, Bloomberg becoming mayor of New York because he has billions of dollars, or Trump becoming president because he's very rich. So things have to change. My question is to all of you is how do we, what's the best mechanism? I mean, some of it is what we are doing, but what else am I missing here? What else can be done?
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have this morning. You've been listening to Professor Mazen Kuncia of Bethlehem University speaking from Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. And this is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.